Come, Watson. Come. The game is afoot.
The game is afoot indeed. I'm really pleased to have our next author guest with us today, Kate Winkler. She has a new book out, and it's about the person who is considered America's Sherlock Holmes. Her new book is titled American Sherlock, Murder, Forensics, and the Birth of American CSI. Maybe you're a fan of CSI. You certainly aren't alone. I know many people are fascinated by forensic techniques, and today we'll talk about the man who pioneered many of them, including things like ballistics, lie detector tests, the use of fingerprints as courtroom evidence. Our guest, Kate Winkler Dawson, a journalist, documentary film producer, and author, and she teaches journalism at the University of Texas at Austin. Her new book is titled American Sherlock, Murder, Forensics, and the Birth of American CSI. Fascinating book. And as you think about this and listen to our guests, why do you find CSI so compelling? Do you have questions about the beginnings of forensic science? Love to hear from you, and I hope you'll give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. And Kate Winkler Dawson, welcome. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, here we've got a really interesting guy, Edward Oscar Heinrich, the subject of your book. What got you interested in writing about him, or maybe about the history of CSI in America?
Well, that was interesting. So the first book that I wrote was called Death in the Air, and it was about one big event and the people who survived the event. So it was about the 1952 smog in London and sort of the host of people in that event who, you know, whether there's a serial killer in it, there's a daughter, there's a, you know, a cop, a doctor. And so I knew for the second book I wanted to sort of do the reverse. I wanted multiple events told through the lens of one person. And so my father was a law professor at the University of Texas here in Austin for 37 years. And so I grew up learning all about forensics, a lot of bad forensics, junk science. My father started the Innocence Project at UT Law School. And so, you know, this was sort of something that I had known my whole life. I used to go to his law school classes. And so for the second book, I really thought delving into the history of forensics would be interesting. But, you know, the books that I write are narrative nonfiction. And so it's, you know, that in that category, it's nonfiction that reads like fiction. So it couldn't just be this survey of how ballistics started, right? I mean, that's not the kind of book it wasn't an academic book. I wanted a real story. And so, I wasn't really sure where to start. If you Google famous forensic scientists, you don't get a huge amount of hits. You know, these are the guys and the women in history who've worked quietly behind the scenes, and they don't make newspaper headlines usually. So I bought a book, which was essentially the history of murder and mayhem in the United States, which started with the Pilgrims, because there was a killer on the Mayflower, and went all the way until the 1970s when the book was published. And that's perfect for me because I really don't have much of an interest after the 1960s. And so I just started flipping through it. It's a massive book, and I refuse to say the name of it because I really think the rest of the books that in my career will come from this one book, so I don't want anybody to get an edge over me. And so I think I got to about page 100, and, you know, I was weeding through gangsters and mafia and poisoners in the 1800s, and I finally landed on this train robbery that's in the book, and it was nicknamed America's Last Great Train Robbery, which was incorrect because these guys actually never robbed the train. They were so inept that they used too much dynamite, and they blew apart the part of the train that had all the money in it, and they killed four people and then took off. And so they actually there was actually no robbery. I read this article, this part of the book, and it mentioned in there the forensic scientist who was called in when local law enforcement and even federal agents sort of hit a brick wall. And it was this man named Edward Oscar Heinrich, and the nickname was America's Sherlock Holmes. So then I go through this sort of checklist when I'm considering doing a project, and I wanted to know, has anybody done a book on him before? And no contemporary person had. There was one done in the 50s, but it wasn't a really serious book. I wanted to know about his impact, and I quickly found out, he was the first to use this whole list of forensics that we use now, like entomology, how bugs arrive to a corpse, geology. He invented something in ballistics. It was very important. And then I needed to know about his archive, and his archive was massive. So I had access. I mean, which is it really was. When I say massive, it's like three underlines. And I was really lucky because I've always been able to work with really big collections, so that I have a good idea of what happened and what these people were like, and I can kind of, pull these conversations out of personal letters. So that was a very long answer to say that I found him in a very odd, obscure book that no one's read, but that I'm so grateful is on my bookshelf.
Well, it's amazing to me that he sort of was lost to history, recent history to me. You write about him, we certainly learn a lot about him and his life, but then you select several cases, which are really fascinating cases that he worked on and solved, or I guess in a case or two, I'm trying to remember now, Bessie Ferguson's ear was one ever did quite solve. But
yeah.
They're all fascinating stories.
Well, the interesting story about that is, as I said, this archive was huge. So it was more than 100 boxes. And he was most certainly OCPD for sure, obsessive compulsive personality disorder. He kept everything. He cataloged everything. He cataloged, he had these massive journals that detailed literally every penny he spent, when he spent it, 5 cents for bread, 20 cents for eggs, the day it happened. He did this for decades and decades. We just found
even
huge amounts.
Even Christmas cards.
He kept his Christmas card. I mean, he kept a journal of his own urine samples for 2 years. I mean, it was all, I think he, in his defense, wanted to start a urinalysis lab, because I know that was kind of an odd thing to keep. But he really obsessively kept stuff, which is fantastic for me. I mean, I'm probably the only one who appreciates it, because that's what you hope for, when you're an author. That being said, Heinrich solved, or at least closed, around 2,000 cases in his 40-something year career as a forensic scientist. And so, my first question to the archivist was, I don't even know where to start. And she said, yeah, it's a lot of criminal cases, and probably about 900 to 1,000 were criminal cases, because he worked on will disputes and, other stuff that wasn't, I found a case file that was so confusing to me. He actually was hired by the parents of a schoolboy to prove that the kid had forged his grades on his report card. So, he made like $50 off that. So there's a lot to go through. And I just said to my archivist who worked on this, what were the thickest files? And I think my editor was a little horrified by that, because it was not me coming through 900 or 1,000 cases. It would have been impossible. And she said, here are the biggest cases. And for me, that made sense, because I want everything. I want photos. He was an avid photographer, so in the book you see there's a lot of photography. He didn't like other people taking photos of his crime scenes, and so I have probably 1,000 photos, personal photos and crime scene photos, and photos of him in his lab. And so I just said, which are the best cases? Which are the ones where there was the most material? And she probably said 20 to 25 cases, and I just honed it into, the 7 or 8 that you see in the book, and you see how his career progresses, you see how forensics progresses. He uses a different tool. And there's two funny things about the book that most people don't realize until I say it. Number one, one of his biggest cases was the silent film star Fatty Arbuckle,
yeah,
who Oscar was basically single-handedly responsible for destroying Fatty Arbuckle's career because of the trial. There's a handprint that's on the cover of the book, and that is actually Fatty Arbuckle's handprint. Oscar marched down to the city jail in San Francisco where Fatty was being held and took his handprint. And then at the top of every chapter is a Sherlock Holmes quote. And if you read the quote and then read the chapter, you'll see that the quote, whatever forensic Sherlock is using in that quote, is what is being used by Oscar in the I thought, in the chapter, I thought I was being clever, but I don't think most people, even my editor, I'm not sure she realized it. So,
Kate Winkler Dawson, our guest today, her book, American Sherlock, Murder, Forensics, and the Birth of American CSI. She's going to be with us right up till 12:30 today, so you'll have a chance to talk with her. And I get the chance to give you a big thank you for your donations during our spring member drive. Support from people like Aaron and Hilbert sustains the news and information you value here. And to ensure we keep these resources in place, if you haven't contributed, I hope you'll do it right now. Go to WPR.org. It's especially important right now for us. And thank you very much. Back with our guests right after this look at the news. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. We are talking about the beginnings of forensic science here in the United States on the show today. Our guest is Kate Winkler Dawson. She's a journalist, documentary film producer, and author. Her new book is called American Sherlock, Murder, Forensics, and the Birth of American CSI. So, questions or comments about forensic science and how it's used to solve crimes? Questions about the person that Kate was writing about, who was the first and was called the Sherlock Holmes of America? It's great to have you with us today. Join in at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. Edward Oscar Heinrich, the focus of the book and some of the cases that he worked on and solved or at least closed. And there are some fantastic cases in Kate's account here. And I hope you'll join in. 800-642-1234. Email at ideas@wpr.org. Kate, I want to go back to when we first talked. You mentioned you sat in your dad's law classes, and someone called in and wondered how old you were when you were sitting in those classes.
Oh, I was of age. I was, 14 or 15, and not too young. But yeah, I mean, it had a really profound experience. A profound effect on me because, I was able to see my dad as an advocate, which I thought was really important. And he was able to explain to me, to someone who was, fairly young, why it was important to have solid forensics and that there is a difference between, good, logical, tested forensic tools and what we now call junk science. And so that gave me a lot of clarity when I was writing the book.
And I'm telling you, Edward Oscar Heinrich, the tools that existed before him, as you say, were, you know, intuition, kind of.
Yeah, it was the third degree, right? I mean, you know, cops who were muffling the witnesses and suspects, and a lot of hunches and a lot of shoe print comparisons, which are pretty problematic. And so there was a lot of guesswork, which was really frightening, because Heinrich started his lab in 1910, but where he hit his stride and where he gained this reputation was about 1920, 1921. And you know, during that time, we're in the middle of Prohibition, which was meant to reduce domestic violence and violence in general. And it instead created, you know, criminal enterprise and increased drunk driving and increased, it was about an 80% increase in violent crime from the decade before. So he, you know, Oscar was busy, and he really came at an important time period in America. And it was a great time period to write about, too. So, you know, this book goes from about 1921 through 1933. So you're talking about Prohibition, then the Roaring Twenties, and then the Great Depression. So those are three of, to me, the most fascinating time periods in America. So it was really great to build those worlds for readers.
Absolutely. It's really a wonderful read. Frank in La Crosse has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Frank.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So my question concerns medical examiners who are often elected or appointed persons with no medical experience at all. And so how does this impact, even though they're not doing, you know, necessarily police or detective work, how does that impact the, you know, cause of death?
Yeah.
I'm sorry, say that last part again.
Well, I think we kind of lost him there. Frank, you still there?
Yeah,
I think
the lawyer on the road there. Can you hear me?
Yeah, so how do the fact that oftentimes medical examiners are sort of elected and maybe not expert, how does that affect outcomes? Is that what you were after?
Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I actually think that's a great point, because you can also pull judges into that discussion. So, you know, even now, judges are asked, and medical examiners too, but judges in particular are asked to weigh whether a forensic tool is valid or not. And, you know, defense attorneys and prosecutors argue about that all the time. Oh, let's allow in bloodstain pattern analysis, you know, and judges, just like some medical examiners, don't have that type of background. They don't have the ability, in some cases, in many cases, to discern between junk science and real science. And a lot of times they'll lean on precedent. Well, this judge let this in Wisconsin, and we're in Texas, and so, you know, we can allow that to come in. And so that is, it's really dicey, I mean, when you do that. And so, you know, things in forensics that were developed outside of law enforcement, so thinking about DNA analysis, thinking about toxicology, these are things that were developed in the scientific community. They've been tested, they've been peer-reviewed, and yeah, DNA evidence can be, you know, problematic. There can be, you know, contamination in a lab, but the technique is solid. Things developed inside law enforcement that don't have to go through that same sort of stringent peer-reviewing and testing and, you know, just like being challenged. Things like fingerprint evidence, you know, shoe print evidence, bloodstain pattern analysis, you know, those are a little more troubling. And so anytime you bring in someone who is a quote-unquote expert, as Frank was saying, who gets on a stand and makes a declaration about how somebody died, as soon as you say expert and they see the you know, hypothetical jacket, white jacket, then who is a jury going to believe? Yeah, they're going to believe someone who's an expert. And then the other side brings in another so-called expert, and we're not sure what their qualifications are. We just know they're there, and they're on the witness stand, and they're saying they're an expert. And now you've got two sides who are opposing each other, and they're disagreeing. So where is a jury left who really is unlikely to have any type of scientific background? They might not even have a college education. They might not have a high school education. We don't know. So it's very confusing. And when we are talking about cases, like capital cases, where there's life and death on the line, and somebody's life, and even in life in prison, you know, it's really hard to demand that that these experts kind of stand up and have, and we hold them to a strong standard. But it's just so unreliable across the country. People who are trained in you know, fingerprint evidence in Wisconsin might be very differently trained than in Florida or in Texas. So it's all kind of a little bit of a mess.
Indeed, but you know, when Heinrich was involved in cases and had to go to in front of juries and talk, he was pretty impressive most of the time, wasn't he?
He was. I mean, you know, he struggled. So he was this guy who loved tweed suits, and he wore little glasses, little spectacles. He always had a very short cropped haircut. He was very neat, and he struggled in many ways with scientific jargon. And he complained in the letters that I had to his best friend, John Boynton Kaiser, who was a reference librarian, who was kind of his Watson. He complained a lot because, you know, Oscar was one of the few experts who would take the stand who was professionally trained. He had a degree in chemistry. He was a sanitary engineer at one point. He was a chemical engineer. So he was trained in all of this. And his training led him to speak sometimes over the heads of jurors who, as I said before, then and now might not be highly educated and might not be able to understand it. I mean, you know, Oscar would use five syllable words from a lab. Yeah. And it took him a good part of a decade to really understand that, you know, just because he has the ability to say these words and say them convincingly doesn't mean that everybody's going to understand it. And so he struggled. Sometimes he would do really well. He was always very confident. That wasn't the issue. He was too confident in many cases. The issue was that he constantly fought against making the jury feel, you know, as if they weren't intelligent enough to follow his logic and his chain of evidence.
Yeah. Dennis in Two Rivers has something I think that relates to this. Let's go there. Dennis, hi.
Yeah, it is related because as far as a jury of our peers, if I'm being tried by a jury of my peers, but let's say one of them has majored in biology and another one has majored in something else, but the other ones just have no scientific background, it seems like, well, they're not necessarily peers because they have such varying abilities to understand what's being presented by these so-called expert witnesses. I'll hang up and listen.
All right. Comment, Kate?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right. I think that's absolutely right. I mean, in an ideal world, in these complicated cases, you would have jurors who understood trigonometry that's involved with bloodstain pattern analysis, you know, who would understand toxicology. But you do have, you know, that's one of the great things about the American system is everybody who's a taxpayer is expected to serve on a jury at some point. Everybody has the opportunity, if you think it's an opportunity or not. But what happens is, because we are in such an adversarial system of justice, you've got two sides. There can only be one winner. And, you know, when you bring an expert up, like we talked about before, who sounds convincing. Okay, so yeah. I'm going to throw my friend who's a defense attorney under the bus here. He and I would have long conversations about this, that he would call an expert on a case, on a big case, usually a murder case. He had a list of experts who met the minimum requirements to to be an expert, so that if they were challenged by the prosecutor would say, you know, the judge would say, well, but this guy has done things before. You know, this person can be put on the stand because he has a record of testifying in ballistics cases. He's a ballistics expert. He wouldn't pick the highest qualified person. He would pick the best talker, right?
Yeah.
Because that's what they have to do, right? You are convincing a jury, not just which way you're saying, but how you're saying it. And again, that comes back to the adversarial system of you know, justice that we have. It's a competition, and there's one person is going to walk away a winner, one side will be a loser. So, you know, it's very confusing to jurors, very confusing. And you'll see in the book, the first and last case, the book is, it's bookended. It's, you know, there's a case from 1933 about a woman who ends up dead. She's a wife, and she's in Stanford. Her husband works for Stanford University there in Palo Alto, California, in 1933. And he goes out into the garden to work one morning, and she's taking a bath. And he comes back, and she's dead, and there's blood everywhere. Ceiling, floor, walls, everywhere. And Oscar's called in by the prosecutor because they arrest the husband for beating her to death, right? And he looks at the evidence, and he says, that's not what happened. He believes that she slipped and fell. So when the husband goes on trial, and I promise I'm not going to ruin anything. I always feel like I do. I always ruin the endings, but I won't ruin this one. But the incredible amount of animosity and just, I mean, tension and anger in the jury room in that particular trial in 1933 was unbelievable. How they pressured one juror into finally just throwing up her hands is what I think is not that unusual in juries. Even today, the amount of peer pressure and the arguments, and you read this all the time, that juries are, you know, they were in tears and usually in a murder case, and there were disagreements, and juries physically fight with each other. So, you know, it's a very, very, it's very difficult for jurors to figure out, you know, who to believe. And so it's a struggle still.
I want our listeners to get an idea of what he was like, Heinrich, in terms that relates to Sherlock Holmes. And I think the train robbery is probably the best, where he takes from a pair of pants.
Yeah, overalls, yeah.
Just, so that gives a good flavor, I think, of what he was like.
Yeah, and so, you know, that the train robbery, which was the Siskiyou train robbery in 1923 in Oregon, really is what put him on the map as America's Sherlock Holmes, because it's still called one of the most amazing feats of collecting and analyzing trace evidence. So trace evidence is the hidden evidence, you know, that is on, you know, shirts or anywhere in a crime scene, really. So in this train robbery, I said these inept robbers blew up the part of the train that they actually were valuing where the money was, and then they took off and they left behind some items. And one was a pair of overalls, bib overalls, denim overalls, and they left it by the detonator to the dynamite. And the local police gather this. This is before the FBI even really existed. I think it was the Bureau of Information at the time. And so they're collecting, the local cops are collecting, and this is rural Oregon also, they're collecting the evidence, and they find this pair of overalls. Southern Pacific Railway sends down some federal agents, and U.S. Postal sends down federal agents because it was a U.S. Postal car that was detonated, that was blown up. And so these federal agents come down, and the local cops look at this pair of overalls, which seems like the biggest clue they have. And the only thing they find on one of the pockets is a bit of mechanic's grease, with which they took the overalls and they went down to the closest garage, found the sketchiest mechanic, I guess is the best way to put it, that was there, and had him put on the overalls, and they sort of fit, and they arrested him. But that wasn't going to be enough evidence. And besides, there were two other robbers that people on the train had spotted. So they send the pair of overalls to Oscar Heinrich. At this time in his career, he was about a decade-ish into solving crimes, and he was usually brought in kind of in the middle of a case. As we get later and later in the book, you see he's brought in right at the very start. But in the early time of his career, he was brought in the middle of cases, sort of when they were stymied, when they didn't know where to go. Then they would call him in and spend the money. So they send him the overalls. They say, we've arrested this guy. There's mechanics grease. We can't find anything else. Federal agents don't know what to do. So he frequently would spend 24 to 48 hours in his lab, in his basement house, right, in Berkeley, California, and he wouldn't sleep. And he would just meticulously collect evidence. And this was a really good example of what I think Oscar's legacy really was. He was a criminology professor at UC Berkeley for decades, and so he taught people how to do this. This really slow, meticulous way of cataloging every note, every measurement, every piece of evidence that he had. And he did it in such a way that was really methodical. It was like, you know, he would start with the hairs. He would collect the hairs. And then he would look at if there was any sort of organic material. And he wasn't haphazard. It was very organized. And he went through and he collected on this pair of overalls probably about 20 to 30 different clues. And, of course, you know, the cops and the federal agents had just come up with this grease spot. So when he looks at this, when he analyzes this mechanic's grease, which is the only thing responsible for keeping a mechanic, you know, from a nearby town in the jail, he looks at it and he realizes it's an organic substance, not inorganic, organic, and he realizes that it's not mechanic's grease. It's pitch from a fir tree from a very specific part of Washington State. Now, for some reason, Oscar owned a pair of logging shoes. I have no idea why. He just happened to have them. He had his secretary bring them in, and he took the overalls and he pinned it to a door, which he then suspended from the center of the ceiling in his lab. And he pinned up the overalls, and the overalls were cuffed at the bottom. And so he put these logging shoes underneath the overalls, and he told his secretary and then later the cops, this is how lumberjacks wear their overalls. They, you know, roll them up at the bottom so that they don't get ruined, and they put them inside their logging shoes, and you could see how this is working. And then he said, here's the rest of the details after he had gone through all of this. He said, this guy is under 5'10". He weighs less than 165 pounds. He's a lumberjack from the western part of Washington State. He has light brown hair. He has very meticulous habits. He knew that because he found fingernail clippings that this guy had been, you know, clipping his fingernails on the job, and he found him in the pocket. So he's building this profile. But what he did that was really sort of definitive in locating the suspect, one of the suspects, was there was in one of the pockets, he used a crochet hook in the pencil pocket, and he found a tiny, tiny piece of balled up paper. He said it was the size of a pea. He steamed it open, and it was part of a U.S. postal receipt that somebody had used, you know, as an alias, and they were able to trace it. And they traced it to one of three brothers, you know, these horrible.
And there they were.
Inexperienced robbers. And there he was, right? And it was one of the D'Otremont brothers. And his profile fit him perfectly. The weight, the height, all of that. So he was one of the first profilers before profiling ever happened in the United States.
It's a fascinating book, Kate. Thank you so much for talking with us about it today. I really appreciate it.
Well, I appreciate it too. Thank you.
Kate Winkler Dawson, her book, American Sherlock, Murder, Forensics, and the Birth of American CSI. Great to have her with us. And great to have you with us. Big thanks if you donated during our spring drive. If you didn't, I hope you'll do it today. Just go to WPR.org. It's especially important for us at this time. Go to WPR.org and make your contribution. I'm Larry Miller. Thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.